Yesterday, ADP reported their job numbers, and it was a little softer than expected, around 150,000 jobs added in the previous month. We get the government number tomorrow, and they don't always line up, so everything can go in another direction tomorrow when we chat. But I wanted to ask Mark Hamrick, who's our Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst for Bankrate. First, Mark, thanks for coming on the program today.
Good to be with you. I did check my watch there for a moment.
Oh, yes, yes, this is not the 6 p.m. show. Here I am at noon, and I'll be back at 6, everybody. So, Mark, you know, the number, you know, any other year you pull 150 out of a hat, you're happy about that, right? And I think people are generally okay with this number being lower than previous months. I guess the million-dollar question, Mark, is this coming down to settle at a comfortable range, or are people maybe more concerned that, all right, it goes down? Then eventually you go down to zero, and then you go the other way. Like, I don't know where we are right now, Mark.
Well, it's probably all the above, right, John? Because we want to see the economy cool in the sense of being in a condition that is consistent with lower prices and less inflation, but we don't want to see it freeze or to see a contraction or a recession. Leaving aside the question, Americans' perception of the economy, many of those perceptions are deeply flawed, which is different than the accurate perceptions they have about their own personal finances. So the real question is, you know, is this a transition? Can we remain at a stable condition with respect to the economy and the job market? Or do we have more severe weakening ahead? And I think right now you have to probably side on the answer that is, stability rather than significant weakening, because that's what the economy has done over the last 2+ years, if not beyond. But of course, the Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates steady. They have a meeting next week, and no change is expected there. No change is expected in interest rates until September at this point, but we have a lot of data to get through between then and now.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people are still using the term stagflation as a worry, and I'm glad that people have different varying opinions on this. It helps us all check our blind spots and put all possibilities on the table. Stagflation, Mark, would be that if we started losing jobs and inflation remained persistently high, which I guess is in the window of possibility, Mark. Anyone you talk to that's smart on this stuff using that word, or just some people making some headlines?
I think a lot of people are doing hot takes as a way of sort of complaining, and the complaint is legitimate from the standpoint of prices are, irritatingly high. The inflation rate is coming down, but we still have elevated prices, and you really can't make the point that the economy is stagnant when you've had GDP outperforming the long-term trend, with the exception of the first 3 months of this year. The outlook for the current quarter is that it'll be consistent with the long-term trend, if not a little bit better than that. This question was posed, by the way, to Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell at his last news conference, which, as you know, I attend. And he said, you know, I was around when we actually had stagflation in the 1970s. And he talked about the fact that the economy was much weaker then than it is now. And he mentioned, of course, that inflation was higher and more persistent than what we've had of late. We have had elevated prices, but we've had inflation coming down. And so what he told us was, I don't see the stag or the flation. And so if you use the definition by the way that it occurred earlier, it's not a legitimate complaint. Could we complain individually or via household or sectors or geographies that we'd like to have the job market so strong that people would be getting wage increases that benefit them individually? Would we like to see better bargains across the board in the inflation environment? Of course. But, the argument just doesn't hold water if you compare it to what we had seen by the previous definition in the 1970s.
Yeah, everyone go Google CPI month by month in the 1970s and early 80s, and you'll see, oh boy, how drastically different it was than the current scenario.
Yeah.
Mark, last question here for you. You mentioned European Central Bank doing mm-hmm. the rate cut. I feel a little bit like when I was a kid and my neighbors got a bouncy house castle in their backyard and I just had the broken down swing set. Why are they doing it and we don't get to do it?
Well, first of all, you know, you didn't have a danger of floating away on that heavy swing set as opposed to the bouncy house, and we're glad you've remained grounded over these many years. The reality is that, you know, inflation has come down a little more aggressively in both Canada and Europe and the Eurozone in the view of those central bankers. But I would say, with respect to what the European Central Bank did today, which was to cut its benchmark interest rate by 0.25%, is that this is viewed as a so-called hawkish cut, hawk being, you know, someone who's still primarily concerned with the fight against inflation, as opposed to dovish, where they're folding their tent, because the central bank did not give any guidance to suggest that further rates are coming. This is more of a fine-tuning, I think, because they believe, and I think, you know, it's probably true, that their current rate level is still restrictive. They would have to cut more substantially for it not to be restrictive. And that's a parallel to the Federal Reserve, which believes in our country that its benchmark rate remains restrictive and needs to be so to continue to try to bring inflation closer to the Fed's 2% inflation target, with their benchmark still in the high 2% range. With hopes for progress on through the summer and fall.
So Europe's like a doctor changing the dosage, but the medication's not going anywhere.
I think that's a good way of putting it, yeah. Another way of putting it is they still have their foot on the brake. You know, I think the consensus right now is that, broadly speaking, rates will remain higher for longer, and barring something that is, you know, as catastrophic as what we saw in the early days of the pandemic and during the great financial crisis, there's no going back to the record low interest rates for all kinds of reasons.
I could sit here and come up with metaphors for this stuff all day long, Mark, but we are out of time. As always, good to talk to you. Hope to talk to you again soon on this program or the evening one, okay?
Always a pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
It's Mark Hamrick. He's great. Bree Fowler joins us. She's a senior writer at CNET, CNET.com. Bree, thanks for coming on the program today again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I can do anything on YouTube. I can find how to renovate basically every room of my house. I've done that. How to fix my toilet. There's been so many things, and I didn't realize, and perhaps naively so, that as of before today, and still for most people, you can show homemade guns on YouTube. You can show how to remove firearm safety devices on YouTube. And I'm not here to judge whether that should be the case or not the case, Bree, but there's been enough public pressure that YouTube is doing something about this, right?
Yeah, they're going to make it harder for kids to see this kind of stuff. You can kind of see how there could be a problem with, you know, a kid watching a video on how to remove a safety device could cause, yeah, you know, massive safety concerns. So they're making an effort to try to keep this stuff away from kids, at least to keep it from auto-playing when the kids aren't, you know, actively trying to subvert controls or see things that they shouldn't. I mean, in a lot of cases, this stuff was just popping up. And what they're going to do is, you know, they're getting prohibiting videos that show how to remove safety devices, but they're also going to restrict videos that show homemade guns, automatic weapons, and certain kinds of firearm accessories like silencers to just people 18 and older to, you know, keep kids from seeing this. You know, I think that's going to be tough. Even if you have the best intentions, but, you know, this is something that safety advocates have been pushing for a long time.
Right. I imagine from the back end of the technology, sure, if you title your video, "Hey, teenagers, here's how you remove a firearm safety device," YouTube could find that pretty easily and pull it. Is this going to be done by AI that somehow culls through all these videos and finds images or videos that would maybe do this to bring it to the attention of humans to try and remove it? Like, how does the inner working of that happen?
Well, if people are posting videos that violate YouTube's terms of service, like, you know, they're going to prohibit the ones that show you how to remove safety devices, you could lose your YouTube account. And these videos would be taken down, that kind of thing. Restricting things to people 18 and older is a little trickier because you're allowing the content, but you're trying to restrict who sees it. And, you know, a lot of kids, they're not using kids' accounts. They're using their parents' account. They're using accounts where they, you know, weren't completely honest about their age. So there's still a good chance a lot of this stuff is going to, you know, end up, at, you know, being seen by kids. And the question is whether, Google, which owns YouTube, is going to be able to enforce these regulations.
I'm sure it's a compromise measure. I'm sure there's some people out there that want way more. Some people don't want any restrictions. It seems to be somewhere in the middle.
Right. I mean, you know, we all believe in free speech. To what extent is kind of up to you. But and being able to find what you need online, you know. But I think a lot of people would agree that the kids just don't need to see this kind of stuff, especially if they're not looking for it. You know, there were things where kids were, you know, people did studies where, you know, they used the profile of what was a young boy looking for video game information. Well, video games, you know, a lot of them have guns and a lot of them, you know, things like that. And just because of the way things were coded or labeled, you know, they were getting gun videos without ever trying to find them, which is really scary.
Yeah. And just a reminder to everyone out there that it's not a First Amendment violation when a private company takes something off their platform.
Absolutely.
Hey, this is interesting. President Joe Biden, his voice made his first court appearance this week in New Hampshire. Walk us through this.
Yeah, this is absolutely wild. This popped up in January during the primaries, specifically in New Hampshire. This guy, who's a political consultant, sent AI-generated robocalls that sounded like they were Joe Biden. I think he used the term malarkey more than once.
Folks?
Yeah, he was trying to sound like Joe Biden, and it told people that, you know, they weren't supposed to vote or that there were problems. You know, they would have problems in November if they did. And this is right before the New Hampshire primary. You know, obviously, this is very concerning. We're worried about deepfakes. We're worried about, you know, people getting the wrong information ahead of the general election. And he has been charged with 13 felonies and 13 misdemeanor charges related to this. He's also facing what is a $6 million fine from the FCC. So he's in some serious trouble. He has claimed before to the AP and others that this was more about a wake-up call to the potential dangers of AI. But, you know, the court will be taking this very seriously.
I don't know if the defense, "I did it to protect the rest of you," ever works in court.
He certainly generated awareness, if that's what he was looking to do. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, for sure. Really quickly, Amazon, the movement to make more people in unions in Amazon. There's a big labor union with Amazon, and their group won a big victory at a warehouse a couple of years ago. Now they're affiliating right with a pretty powerful union group.
Yeah, they are joining the Teamsters. And this is something that they kind of need because it's a very small labor union. You know, they organize themselves, this warehouse out on Staten Island, which is technically part of New York City, and, you know, decided that they wanted to unionize. But it's very hard to negotiate a contract when you're just, you know, a startup grassroots kind of organization, especially when you're dealing with a company like Amazon. So they're joining up with the Teamsters, which, you know, they've got some muscle and some teeth and history to them. And hopefully this will kind of, you know, right the ship for them.
Yeah.
They, you know, were unable to organize a couple other warehouses. They've had some leadership issues. And this is going to give them resources and hopefully some brain trust to kind of get their movement going.
You mentioned muscle and teeth. The leader of the Teamsters almost got in a fist fight with the senator last year in a committee hearing. So, yeah, that's there. Bree, I got to scoot. Thanks so much. You always do a great job on this program, okay?
Thanks for having me.
That's Bree Fowler, senior writer, CNET, CNET.com. I know there's a storyline out there about malls, and for the most part, a lot of part, they're true. I saw one mall, I forget which one I was at, where they converted a two-story, maybe it was a JCPenney or a Sears, into a laser tag place, which actually was a really cool repurposing of the mall. But there is a place that's kind of bucking that trend, and Fashion Outlets of Chicago, and you see them off the Tri-State Tollway if you've never been inside of one, they are certainly doing that, doing it differently. Katie Walsh, thanks for joining us here today. We appreciate it. Hello, Katie.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Did I get that right? I mean, you guys are growing. You're seeing businesses and brick and mortars making sure they come to you and be a part of what you're doing.
Absolutely. We, Fashion Outlets of Chicago, has really become a destination for luxury outlet retailers. They're making their only home in the Midwest here at Fashion Outlets of Chicago, and it's great. It gives people a reason to come to Rosemont and to come shopping with us.
How do you do it differently than some of the other malls we've seen, which are going the other direction?
That's a great question. You know, really the goal is to create an unparalleled shopping experience. We have more here than just great retail. We have wonderful shopper amenities. We have a full-service concierge team. We have an amazing contemporary art collection all throughout the shopping center with rotating exhibitions and new art coming in all the time. So it really gives the customer a reason to come here and spend some time with us.
Yeah, and I imagine as places, these big companies or these you know, these luxury brands are looking for places to go, they want to go to a place that looks like that and feels like that. I imagine that's part of it, too. It's not only attracting the people there, but it's cyclical, too. You want to, it's the chicken and the egg. You also want to attract the businesses to be like, hey, if we're going to limit the number of brick and mortars we have, we can be a little bit more choosy. Let's choose ones that look good, feel good.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the luxury brands have really realized that Fashion Outlets of Chicago is kind of a diamond in the rough here in the Midwest. And the leasing success we've had here has really shown that the customers want to be here and the retailers want to be here. We have, I think, 8 retailers this year that are going to be going through remodels just to enhance their store, to improve them and refresh them. So it does show our retailers really are investing in the center as well.
Is there something about where you are, too, that just kind of contributes to it? Like, you have the ballpark nearby, the casinos nearby, there's a lot of entertainment nearby, restaurants nearby. It can be part of a day that people spend in a basically like a square mile.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Rosemont is really the perfect place to be, as you said. There's dining, there's a ton of entertainment. There's so much to do besides shopping, and a lot of the experiences here in general in Rosemont are unique to the area. So it really has made kind of that whole area a destination to come to Rosemont, come to Fashion Outlets. And then, of course, our location, our proximity to O'Hare. We definitely have a lot of tourists who are coming in, and they're familiar with the shopping center and the brands that we have, and they're coming to shop before they head downtown, which is great. We welcome them all.
I got to be honest, Katie, you're fighting an uphill battle with me, and that's because I don't think I've ever been to an outlet mall to begin with, and I've always now that I kind of am in my rut of where I shop and what my sizes are, I do it a lot online. What am I missing by not visiting you?
Oh, that's, you know what? I'm glad you asked that question. So, I mean, I talked about the experience, right? When you come here, there's going to be so much more to do than just clicking a button online. I think the other part is the great deals. Being an outlet shopping destination, our stores are offering up to 75% off every day. So you can find some of those deals online. But our stores here are carrying a lot of unique product that isn't available online because they are outlets. Our outlet stores get a lot of discontinued product from the full price stores, or even maybe product that was only sold in Europe could come in to our location. And you won't know that unless you come into Fashion Outlets and into our brands to see what they're offering.
I guess part of the impetus could be what I said at the beginning of the question, which is I'm in a rut. What a good way to kind of reframe what you're wearing or what you're buying by just physically walking through and seeing it.
Yeah, I mean, there's still something about being able to try on that outfit, make sure those shoes really fit the way that you're looking for, and then plus the fact that you can get them at a great deal always helps.
I love that Fashion Outlets of Chicago is located at 5220 Fashion Outlets Way. Did you have some sway in being able to change the name of the street?
You know, the mayor is a great partner, Mayor Stevens, to Fashion Outlets of Chicago, and he helped make that happen.
Yeah, I like that. Can't get lost on Fashion Outlets Way. Okay, yep. Anything else you want to add? Katie, you got about 30 seconds.
Oh, just please come visit us if you haven't been. We've opened so many new stores. Alexander McQueen just opened an outlet location, and Vuori is going to be opening up an outlet soon. So there's really a lot for the customer to come see and take advantage of.
Spend your day there. Okay, Katie, have a good one. All right, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Time for the Wintrust Business Minute. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The new owner of Oberweis Dairy is planning an upgrade and expansion. The Hoffman family of companies bought Oberweis out of bankruptcy, but says it will keep the name, management team, and ice cream recipes. Cranes reports upgrades are planned for the company's North Aurora manufacturing plant with an eye toward capacity expansion. Upgrades are also coming for 40 Oberweis ice cream shops. The company also has plans to open more shops in the Chicago area and other parts of the country. Oberweis home delivery will also expand. Hoffman bought Oberweis for about $21 million. Chicago-based workspace company Workbox has opened its first Texas location in Dallas. It's the company's largest workspace outside of Chicago and the latest in the company's ongoing expansion. Workbox has also raised about $17 million in Series A funding with a follow-on option for an additional $5.5 million. The company says the new funding will allow it to accelerate growth to other locations. Workbox has raised a total of about $25 million. It has 10 locations in 5 cities, including Chicago, Columbus, Minneapolis, Salt Lake City, and now Dallas. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, Business of Food, Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And yesterday on the Business of Food, we heard the story of a farmer who was getting a field ready to plant corn when he spotted something shiny in the dirt.
A gold coin that dates back to the Civil War.
And goes on to find nearly 800 more. Lots of questions like where'd the coins come from? How much did he sell them for? Answers after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. On the phone is...
My name is Chip Polston. I am the host and a producer for Kentucky Life, a program on KET here in Kentucky.
Yesterday, Chip told the story of a still unidentified Kentucky farmer who found the 770 Civil War-era gold coins in one of his fields. Any idea how they got there?
So there's several schools of thought. The dates appear to line up at a time in the Civil War when there was a group called Morgan's Raiders that were ripping through Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. These were basically a group of Confederate soldiers, and they were just going through and looting and rampaging in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different places, so that they actually had pillaged and plundered and robbed so many people that they could not carry it all. They buried the gold thinking they were going to come back for it, and either the people involved with it were maybe killed in battle or just plain forgot where they had put it.
After the farmer found the coins, he contacted a coin expert in Kentucky named Jeff Garrett.
And Jeff just absolutely could not believe that he had come across this.
So they got on a plane to Florida to see a collector for appraisal and sale.
He and the farmer together got on an airplane with more than $3 million in gold coins with them.
Nervous? Yeah, Jeff told Chip.
We don't talk. We don't acknowledge each other. We don't sit together. We don't book our tickets at the same time. But they got the coins to Florida, and that's where the deal was brokered, and they were sold from there.
For how much?
For more than $3 million.
That farmer's identity remains a secret. He does not want fortune hunters traipsing through his fields. Chip and his team at KET put together a half-hour program about the farmer's fields of gold.
You can watch it online at our website, ket.org. You can find it on our YouTube channel there.
And look for the Great Kentucky Hoard. On the food calendar, today's National Applesauce Cake Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
I was reading from Madison Saavedra, great reporter, a colleague of mine over at Block Club Chicago, about this great Edgewater Candles. And Pete booked him here on the show today to talk about all that they do for their neighborhood and running a small business. Mark Towns joins us now. Mark, great to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Edgewater Candles.
So we are a candle making shop where you can come and smell our candles, buy some candles, and make candles at certain classes throughout the month. And we also have other scent products like bath salts and incense and wearable aromatherapy and soap. And we are a gay-owned business. And to celebrate Pride, we have created a line of candles that celebrate each and every neighborhood and community area in Chicagoland.
Oh, that's cool. So each neighborhood has a different sort of candle. Am I understanding that correct?
Yeah. Well, so we've got a real pretty piece of art we've created for every place from Albany Park all the way to Wrigleyville. It's 108 different neighborhoods and community areas you can select. Because we really wanted to give people an opportunity to express pride with their own neighborhood.
Is the candle itself different or just the artwork that surrounds the candle?
The artwork, yeah,
oh,
the
cool.
Artwork is a really colorful rainbow effect with a lovely heart and the progress flag motif.
And I imagine, and I am reading here, in fact, that you, some of these proceeds are going to go to the Trevor Project, right?
That's right, exactly, yeah. 20% of every one of our Pride candles go to the Trevor Project, which is a crisis hotline that is for people who are in crisis, that are queer youth, and this hotline is there for them via text or on their website, or it's, you know, you can call them, all kinds of ways to get in touch.
Edgewater Candles, by the way, is at 1050 West Bryn Mawr Avenue. Okay, well, Mark, is this what you've been doing your whole life? Was this a side hustle that turned into a main hustle? Walk us through your small business story.
Yeah, it was a hobby that sort of, I just kept on doing it, and it was the first, this is the seventh business I've started. All the rest are no longer, and I learned from all of those. And this one is really resonating with the community. And so it started as a hobby. The Edgewater Chamber of Commerce invited us to the craft shows and the farmers markets. And that really put the wind in our sails. And so we started doing upwards of 70 craft shows a year, to the point where now we have our store in Edgewater. We have a mobile boutique in the form of a 1969 Volkswagen camper that we sell candles out of. And we have a production facility in Evanston. And in a, what I think is a lovely full circle moment, I am now the newest board member of the Edgewater Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Has the brick and mortar been a boom for you? Did it take a little time for it to make the investment make sense? Were you going on a risk, or did it all just make sense to start it there?
It was kind of scary, to tell you the truth, to begin opening a store on the street in my namesake neighborhood, selling a product that is, you know, about self-care and, you know, it's not an essential like milk or bread. But yeah, the community has come out to support us. Our loyal customers drive from all over the city to take our classes and stock up on room sprays and gifts around the holidays and all that kind of good stuff. So it's been a fantastic part of our story so far.
You bring up such a great point there that you candles last a fairly long time unless you're just burning 30 of them all the day. And you almost have to be, I mean, in Edgewater, it's a great neighborhood, great walkability, but you also probably want to be something where people come to you for, almost like maybe a travel destination is the wrong way to put it, but you are a spot where people want to go no matter where in the city you're from.
That's right. We've crafted a really beautiful space here, and we're proud of it because it beautifies the entire street. You know, Bryn Mawr, like a lot of commercial districts, really took a kick in the teeth during the lockdown. And so we're one small part of brightening the historic district of Bryn Mawr and being a good neighbor. And yeah, there's pretty things to look at and pretty things to smell and really exciting classes to make your own candle and express your creativity through scent.
You guys feel like you're growing at a good pace, that you're scaling up? I mean, obviously opening the brick and mortar is a good sign.
It is. Thank you. It is a good pace. We introduced foaming soaps and room sprays last year. This year, we've introduced bath salts and car diffusers. Coming up next is lotion and gel soaps.
It's cool. I mean, imagine you just have to kind of reinvent what in the smellscapes you can do and provide and look to create them. It doesn't happen out of thin air, though. You probably have to do a ton of research before you start introducing products to the neighborhood.
You're right. I've been testing our bath salts. It's been laborious. I'm kidding. I've been taking baths with our salts for over a year now. And after a while, I'm like, okay, I think I've got the ratio of, you know, pink salt to Epsom salt to gray salt, and then how much fragrance goes in there. And yeah, then we got to bring it to our line, and it's been really exciting.
That's great. Mark Towns we're talking with, by the way, from Edgewater Candles. Mark, we have a lot of listeners who started side hustles in the pandemic that grew into main hustles and maybe are thinking about brick and mortar or something along those lines. What's your advice to a small business owner who is trying to wonder if it's time to make the leap?
I'd say call your Chamber of Commerce. Find out who's representing your neighborhood, because the Chamber of Commerce's sole job is to help businesses in that area. And they might help you find out where the, you know, great retail spaces are, what sort of PIF incentives there are, or SBA opportunities. Our Chamber of Commerce has linked us up with all sorts of interesting grant opportunities and side street beautification opportunities. And that's the reason why we joined the chamber. And then the great thing about opening a brick and mortar is that your customers get a chance to support you all the time and immediately, not place an order on the website, wait for it to ship, or wait till the farmer's market opens on, you know, Monday. So it's really cool to be a place where people can walk in, and our loyal customers will bring in family and friends that are visiting from out of town. And so it's a really cool thing for us to get to be something that people show off to their family and friends.
Well, Mark, that doesn't just happen by accident. You obviously have great products, but obviously you and Stephen do a great job being good community members, right? Like, people bring people not to their favorite candle store, but to their favorite business owner who happens to have candles there too. You must be doing something right, Mark. Congrats on the success so far. Best of luck on the rest of it, okay?
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I appreciate it.
And it's 1050 West Bryn Mawr in Edgewater. Edgewater Candles. Just one of those wonderful neighborhoods. If you haven't visited in Chicago, walk around. It's wonderful.